All right, the J.J. Johnson Quintet with Bags Groove. And that was recorded on August the 29th, 1958, with J.J. Johnson, of course, on his signature trombone, Nat Adderley on cornet, Tommy Flanagan on piano, Wilbur Little on bass, and Albert Heath of the Heath Brothers on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is day four in the debacle going on in Washington, D.C., and we're not going to be talking about that. We have more important things to talk about right now, and that is concerning Dr. Jeffrey B. Perry, who concludes his Black History Month special presentation on the great internationalist Hubert Henry Harrison, dubbed by leading intellectuals of his day the father of Harlem radicalism. So we're going to be talking a bit about that and closing out the week-long program, which we've had the exquisite joy and privilege of being tutored personally by Dr. Perry. And he, as just to remind you, has just completed a two-volume set on Harrison, which has been, of course, printed by Columbia University Press. And he took us through the whole panorama of Harrison's life and his significance. But today, it's your last chance to ask questions before we close it out. Today's your last chance at 888-874-4888. But we can't start the program officially without commending you and thanking you, Jeffrey, for your work, for honoring us with your personal presence, and for having us in your virtual classroom this entire week. I thank you so much for that, and I am delighted to once again be joined with you in a project. Before, it used to be in print a lot more than radio, but I am just delighted to be working with you again. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Eutrice. Thank you so very much, and my feelings are very similar towards you and towards your audience. I mean, this has been a joy for me, and I'm eager to go on. let's carry on.
888-874-4888. You may have questions that you didn't get a chance to ask, or something just occurred to you that you want to ask before it's too late, at 888-874-4888. Jeff, could you, to get things started in that direction, give us an idea from your perspective, besides what you've written, this 1,588-page, two-volume work on Harrison, who comes to mind as your next project?
You geez, 74 years old. This took 39 years.
Well,
I'm going to be putting out a Harrison collection of his writings, hopefully later this year, for Oxford University Press. And I'm going to be doing an updated version of Theodore W. Allen's two-volume The Invention of the White Race for Verso Books also later this year. They're both already in progress, and they will take up a lot of my time. But I still want to do a lot of speaking on Harrison, and I want to get it out there. I want to stress, I thank you so much for mentioning the books. I want to stress also, readers can get the books at a 20% discount from Columbia University Press using code CUP20, stands for Columbia University Press 20. That's a 20% discount. And I encourage everybody to try and get the books, but if they can't, to try and get them in their public library or their university or college library so they can read them and others can read them and learn of Harrison. Also, Utrice, if you want to start this way, before we really hit the questions, I put together about 20 bullet points that may be of interest for listeners today, you know, to just go over Harrison a little and things, some of which I've said before, but some of which are new and listeners may find of interest. So however you want to proceed.
Okay. So why don't we start with that?
Okay. Hubert Harrison, Arthur Schomburg said Hubert Harrison was ahead of his time. Harrison understood white supremacy to be central to capitalist rule in the U.S. He emphasized that those desiring significant social change would have to struggle against it to succeed. He emphasized that black people should develop race consciousness as both a measure of self-defense and as a key strategic component in that struggle. He understood that in the U.S., African Americans are the, quote, touchstone of the modern democratic idea. He understood that while the color line exists, the cant of democracy is intended as dust in the eyes of white voters and used in wartime to mask sordid imperialist aims. He understood that true democracy and equality for African Americans implies a revolution startling to even think of. That's the first. Harrison's consistent call for racial and political equality carried through when he was with the Socialists in 1912, when he founds the Liberty League in 1917, through his last organization, the International Colored Unity League, from 1924 until his death in 1927. He played unique signal roles in the largest class radical movement of his era, the Socialist Party, and the largest race radical movement of his era, the New Negro / Garvey movement. We can get into more specifics on that. He profoundly influenced a generation of new Negro militants and common people. In his era, he was the most, amongst the black activists, he was the most class conscious of the race radicals and the most race conscious of the class radicals. And he had a profound influence on people like A. Philip Randolph, Marcus Garvey, and others. He was a radical internationalist, as pointed out by Richard B. Moore and many others. Harrison's approach was race-conscious, class-conscious, scientific, internationalist. He emphasized the common people. He was a master of the mass approach in his day. This is pre-TV and pre-internet, and he was the leading soapbox orator, and he was a brilliant newspaper writer and editor. He believed in direct action. He was proactive. He wasn't going to wait around for white people to come around, right? He understood the interrelation of literature and the arts. And this is, you'll see throughout the both volumes with his interactions with leading writers and artists of his period. He is anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist, and scientific, and as his two children told me before they died, he understood the challenge to white supremacy was central to opposition to capitalist rule. John Henry Clark has been brought up a few times in the sessions, and in 1997, when he wrote an introduction to Harrison's book, When Africa Awakes, he pointed out that the strong and clear voice of Hubert Harrison is speaking to us again. I hope this time we will listen. Let us try to complete the important theoretical work that he started, and that can only be repeated in 2021. I haven't pointed this out before, but when Harrison died, he was buried in an unmarked grave in Woodlawn Cemetery in the Bronx. In 2014, a number of people got together to raise money for a gravesite, and the gravesite was placed in September. But since then, also of great interest, is that Harrison's portrait has been placed on a wall at the Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., along with Alain Locke. The two share a wall on the New Negro, showing the growing importance of Harrison. Why is Harrison not better known, or hasn't he been? Because he was a radical, besides all, he was black, poor, immigrant, et cetera, all the standard reasons black people have been not represented fully in history. He was a radical on class, race, religion. He was a forthright critic. He had no long-lasting organizational ties. He dies young. And how history is written and reviewed. I touched on that last topic a little bit previously. But if we have time at the end of the show, I have a nice 35-second tape, which people might be interested in hearing. J.A. Rogers explains that most of the enmity against Harrison was incurred by his devastating candor. He spoke out freely what he thought, and more often than not, it was with such an annihilating sarcasm and wit that those whom he attacked never forgave him. There was, however, no personal malice in Harrison's share. He was willing to shake hands with an opponent as soon as he descended from the platform. That's when he was on the soapbox. I mentioned something about Harrison as an autodidact. I repeatedly mentioned it. And yesterday I mentioned George W. Stocking, but I want to just read the quote accurately now. And it's in Stocking's book, Victorian Anthropology, which was written in 1987. I think it's a very perceptive comment. And Stocking writes, "Standing outside the normal process by which intellectual traditions are transmitted, the autodidact may embody the spirit of his age in an unusually direct way." I think that was the case with Harrison. Hodge Cannon from Montserrat wrote something very interesting 2 months after Harrison died in a black weekly called the New York News, not to be confused with the Daily News. And he writes, "It has now become a subject of popular discussion among thoughtful people as to reasons for the absence of any mention of the late Hubert Harrison in the columns of the three leading Negro monthly periodicals in this country. The Messenger," that's Randolph's publication, "A Journal of Scientific Radicalism, has not a word to say concerning the death of the first and ablest Negro exponent of scientific radicalism. The Crisis," that's Du Bois's publication, "a record of the darker races, laments the passing of Boxer Tiger Flowers, but omits to record the services of a man who was a lecturer for the Board of Education and of whom William Pickens, who was Yale educated, says, can speak more easily, effectively, and interestingly on a greater variety of subjects than any other man I have ever met, even in the great universities. Opportunity, the publication of the Urban League and a Journal of Negro Life, is equally silent over the demise of an acknowledged first-rate thinker, one who gave liberally to the intellectual life of the Negro and whose writings have appeared in that journal." Kiernan concludes, "This concerted silence is ominous. It does appear that there is something wrong somewhere." Just a couple more little quick quotes. When Harrison starts his diary, he writes, "I'm going to put things down as they come. This may serve in some sorts as a history of myself, twisted of two threads, what I do and what I think. I shall hope I shall not make any conscious effort to impress upon it a character of any sort. So far as life is concerned and as it comes, so must it be set down." And he does that in his diary, which is freely available online at Columbia University's Rare Book and Manuscript Library digital collections. And I have all the links to it in my volume 2. Another thing that's fascinating is something he wrote in his diary in 1907, but I hadn't mentioned before, and it's a little piece he writes. It's a pledge to the mother race from an untamed, untamable African. He writes, "Poor heart-sore and soul-starved mother race, who shall minister to thy deep desires? Who shall bind up thy wounds and raise thee up again if these and such as these are to be thy prophets and thy priests? O Africa, when shall be the term of thy long degradation? Behold, here, even now, I pledge thee, O my mother, that I shall devote my years to thee, shall work for the redemption even in the land of thine exile, and set before mine eyes an ideal of service to thee, inextricably blent with service for myself, shall love thee and be proud of thee and glory in the power now lying dormant, and shall strive to bring it to the light. Take my youth, my labors, my love, my life, my all, and do thou, when I shall have died for thee, take me to thy bosom, an untamed, untamable African." Harrison was also an intellectual in full touch with the life of his people, and he writes in his diary how, in order to write their history, he looks for a full picture of their history, and he haunts the YMCA, the YWCA, the White Rose Home, disreputable clubs, streets of evil, and sordid associations, and so on. He really gets deep into the community. Again, just about here at the end now. It's important to remember Harrison challenged the two main ideological props of white supremacy, the idea that racism is innate and the idea that, quote, white workers, quote, benefit from race prejudice. His quote about the touchstone true democracy and equality implies a revolution startling to even think of. I think I got three or four more left. In 1912, when he's with the Socialist Party, he explains that the duty of the party to champion the Negro's cause is as clear as day. This is a crucial test of socialism's sincerity. That's Harrison in 1912 in the leading journal of the Socialist Party. A year later, Du Bois writes, "The Negro problem then is the great test of the American socialist." And everybody cites Du Bois all the time, but Harrison preceded it by a year. Similarly, Harrison precedes Du Bois in this very insightful comment in the International Socialist Review in 1912. "The 10 million Negroes of America form a group that is more essentially proletarian, and under slavery they were the most thoroughly exploited of the American proletariat." And this understanding of enslaved black workers as proletarians is profoundly important. When Du Bois starts Black Reconstruction, he opens the first chapter is on the black worker, right? And if we understand black labor as proletarian, even under slavery, then they're not, black workers are not excluded from labor history, because I that used to be my field of study, and we have all these history books which start in the 1800s and exclude black labor entirely. But it also enables us, as Theodore W. Allen points out in his work, to get back to the origins of the invention of the white race in terms of labor questions, and it peels off a lot of the layers that hide the true story. Couple more things. Harrison, as he was leaving the Socialist Party, he offered what is arguably the most profound but least heeded criticism in U.S. leftist history. He stated simply, "The Socialist Party, like the labor movement, has insisted on white race first and class after. It put the white race first before class." Harrison in Race Unity, Harrison wrote that the fault with previous efforts was that the uniters, such as Booker T. Washington and W.E.B. Du Bois, had generally gone at the problem from the wrong end. They have begun at the top when they should have begun at the bottom. To attempt to unite the intellectuals at the top was not the same thing as uniting the Negro masses, the key to racial solidarity. Interestingly, in 1940, in his autobiography, Dusk of Dawn, Du Bois reached a similar conclusion. So Harrison, when he founds the Liberty League, it's race conscious, it's international, it's mass-based, demands political equality, social justice. It preaches armed self-defense, family self in the face of lynching and white supremacy. He's very militant on all these issues. It's a proactive policy. It's not going to be dependent on whites. I have chapters and words on Harrison's influence on Garvey, but here is one from Anselmo Jackson. He writes, "Garvey publicly eulogized Harrison, joined the Liberty League, and took a keen interest in its affairs. Harrison rendered memorable service and constructive community to the Negro masses of Harlem. It may be truly said that Harrison was the forerunner of Garvey and contributed largely to the success of the latter by preparing the minds of Negroes through his lectures." Regarding Harrison's influence on Garvey, W.A. Domingo, the first editor of the Negro World, Garvey's paper, said, "Garvey came at the psychological moment. However, before him, there was Hubert Harrison. He was a brilliant man, a great intellectual, a socialist, and highly respected. Garvey, like the rest of us, followed Hubert Harrison." Harrison himself claimed with considerable basis that from the Liberty League, quote, "Garvey appropriated every feature that was worthwhile in his movement," end quote, and that the secret of Garvey's success was that he, quote, "held up to the Negro masses those things which bloom in their hearts, racialism, race consciousness, racial solidarity, things taught first in 1917 by the voice in the Liberty League." And then again, just to wrap this up, Harrison, consistent calls were for racial and political equality throughout from 1912 through his death in 1927. Time for coffee.
Thank you. Thanks for that.
888-874-4888, and you will be able to converse or just let us know what you're thinking about the series by Jeffrey Perry. You're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We just came through a little muck and mire, electronically speaking, and hopefully we're okay now. Are you there, Jeff? Okay, so 888-874-4888 is the number to call to ask a question of Dr. Jeffrey Perry about the series, which is coming to a close today, that he has done on Hubert Harrison. I wanted to say a special thank you, as I did, because it is rare that we have excitement about somebody of African descent in this country and history. It's very rare to have both together. And all the more rare to have somebody of the caliber of Hubert Harrison. And I'm urging you, encouraging you to get the two-volume work. As I said, together it's 1,588 pages. So it's a very substantive work. And you should have a copy at home. And you should read it consistently. And you should read it not only for yourself, but for your family. This is a very important work about a very important person. And we tend to learn about others, and I'm not suggesting that, you know, we should deny one and claim the other. But we should understand how important his work was in shaping not only the historicity of the works of many African Americans, but of Hubert Harrison in particular, whose life was a model for how people, scholars in particular, should live with a sense of directness and honesty. 888-874-4888 is the number to call. We're okay now. We have fixed whatever the little glitch was. Are you there with us, Jeff? Okay, not yet, but he'll be back shortly. Again, if you're calling in, please be prepared to ask a question. And because it's the appropriate environment in which you can get a great answer. And hopefully you have listened to previous episodes, and so you have a more targeted question that would be of benefit to you when Jeff answers your question. 888-874-4888. If you find yourself waiting for a minute, this is what happens in radio. Sometimes you're not immediately cued. You just have to wait for just 1 second, and then we cue you in, and all else, you know, ensues as normal. But 888-874-4888. From what you have listened to this week, what strikes you as being extremely significant about the lecture series? Anything come to mind, something extraordinary that stands out in your mind about what was covered this week? And what would it prompt you to do? Okay.
That was a cat.
Are we all on some kind of medication today? I don't understand it. But anyway, 888-874-4888. I'm not seeing anybody in queue at the moment.
Utrecht, may I just add two little things? One,
sure.
Again, if people, my webpage is www.jeffreybperry.net. There is all kinds of free information on Hubert Harrison and also on Theodore W. Allen, who I write about. I mean, much video, audio, articles. So I encourage people to go there, www.jeffrey, JeffreyBperry.net. And also, I love the fact that we're doing this on your show, because it was about 100 years ago that Harrison delivered the first of his three talks on radio in New York, and it's kind of commemorative of sorts. You know, I mean, he was a real pioneer in that area, too.
Well, we look like we have sorted out whatever it is that needed to be sorted out. Kojo from New York, you're on the air.
Thank you so much for this program, Utrecht. I remember when you did it a couple
of
years
ago. There's something
I'm getting.
It was
so outstanding. But the question
Kojo,
is,
hold on for a second, please. Hold on for a second. There's an echo coming from your end. Is there a radio on?
Well, let me cut the radio off.
Thank you.
My question is, how did Hubert Harrison influence Paul Robeson? With Paul Robeson's close ties, I know, to Du Bois and so forth, but how did it seem like he was a perfect mentor in a way for Robeson, being the international, the languages, and all of those particulars.
In answer to that question, Utrecht?
Yes.
Okay. Harrison's on the scene, and he winds up passing away before he has, I think, a chance to have much contact. I don't know if he had any contact with Robeson. He did a major review of the play The Emperor Jones by Eugene O'Neill, in which Charles Gilpin, the leading black actor of his day, did a splendid performance. Harrison corresponded with O'Neill, and it's fascinating correspondence, and people would be interested in that. But this is before Robeson succeeds Gilpin as the lead actor in that play. But what's interesting is Eslanda Cardoza Good, who I believe I want to get the mother and the daughter, I don't want to get them mixed up, but I think Eslanda Cardoza Good is Robeson's future wife, and she sells Harrison's newspaper, The Voice. She's one of the regular sellers and distributors of his paper. So there are some ties there, but I don't know, I don't think I have anything in that I've come across where he's communicating directly with Robeson or vice versa.
Thank you. G from New York, you're on the air.
Okay, thank you. Hello, Utrecht.
Hello.
I'm really into your guest, Dr. Perry. I really enjoyed your show tremendously. This whole week I've been really interested, and I started looking up Mr. Harrison again. What I'd like to know is, after Mr. Hubert Harrison passed away very young, how did his wife and children carry on? And, well, I guess mainly is that. How did they fare after he passed?
That's a very good question. And when he dies in poverty. His family has no money, virtually. Caspar Holstein, who comes from St. Croix, from the Virgin Islands, and also is involved in numbers in Harlem, but he's got some money, and he's a prominent in social activities, too, and social causes, progressive social causes, pays for Harrison's funeral. Shortly after Harrison's death, a fellow named Ethelred Brown, who's a minister, a Unitarian minister, decides to set up a Hubert Harrison Memorial Church. It's a little bit ironic, since Harrison was an atheist/agnostic, but they set up this church, which goes on for about a decade, holding regular meetings in the spirit of Harrison and guest speakers and the like. And they contributed money, some money to Harrison's family, and also to having pictures of Harrison placed, amongst other places, in the central lobby of the 135th Street Library. But Harrison's family, as I said, lives in poverty. He has four daughters and a son, and they range in age from 17 to 7 when he dies. And two of the daughters die young, around 1931. I have the exact dates, of course, in the book. And it's, I believe in both cases, it's from tuberculosis.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very tragic. And the one who's the younger of the two, Ilva, was apparently just a brilliant student, you know, and she started working at the library at a very young age. But despite all those hardships, his family persisted. And as I mentioned, the two members of his family who I got to know when I started out back about 40 years ago, son William was a lawyer in New York, you know, and he did this basically on his own through hard work. And his sister, Ada, was a teacher and then a vice principal and in her last years a principal. And this is in the 1960s. It's quite an achievement for a black woman in New York City school system. So they were always at the edge of poverty. That when I spoke with them, that they stressed that to me. That's what they knew all their lives, you know, in their early years.
And did he die of? Was it suspicious at all?
What he died of was he went into the hospital for an appendix condition, and he was on the verge of coming out. And then, as the story goes, his appendix ruptured, and he took a turn for the worse and died in December 17th, 1927. His family to this day has suspicions about the cause of his death. Just on that, parenthetically, I'll point listeners to an article I did on his grandson, Ray Richardson, who, like Hubert, was brilliant and had a black TV show that preceded Gil Noble's Like It Is. The black TV show was called Say Brother up in Boston, and it was militant and it was political, but it was cultural. And after Ray Richardson went into New Bedford, Mass, after a series of racist attacks and fight back, they took him off the air. It was too militant because he brought, instead of talking heads, he brought the crew in and for 6 days interviewed the people. And Ray Richardson dies in Mexico in 1971 under very suspicious conditions. And there's more to this story, but I have two articles. It's basically the same article in Black Star News or Black Agenda Report. And if you Google Ray Richardson and Hubert Harrison, you'll learn all about that and also all about Say Brother. It was an amazing group that they pulled together. They put out this regular TV show in Boston, aired on Thursday nights and again on the weekend.
Thank you.
And we can get your book from Columbia University.
We have to move on, G. Sorry. Josh, you're on the air with Jeffrey Perry.
Oh, this is Josh.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, thank you. This is Josh from Washington Heights, the victim of the earlier, what did you call them? Murk and muck, you trees. I'm glad I was able to get through. Ultimately, my question is, what can we take from this magisterial uncovering of an inspiring figure with regard to our work today? I've spent a lifetime trying to navigate the interconnections of race and class. And before I continue, Richard, let me call your attention to a contemporary activist who you may know of or may not, named Saladin Muhammad in North Carolina, the leader of a group called the Black Workers for Justice and United Electrical Workers Local 150. Are you familiar with him?
I heard the name, yes, but I'm not familiar.
Uh-huh. Well, if you're interested, I'll be glad to send you a film that I made about him, if I can find out how. But my experience over many decades has led me to be very pessimistic, because despite what many have tried, the reality that the protagonist of this book has stated so eloquently with regard to the Socialist Party has been true ever since, that race has always prevented a unified movement for equality, democracy, humanity in this country.
What is your question, though? What is your question?
And please speak louder, Josh. It's very hard to hear.
The question is, what should we take from this today, from this presentation, in terms of our work for going forward?
If I may, Utrice?
Yes.
Yeah, I think, again, I tried to lay out yesterday and a little bit today. I think Harrison points out the importance of having clarity on what we're dealing with. It's capitalist, it's white supremacist, it's imperialist, that white supremacy is central to how they maintain control, and it's the issue we have to take them on. And it also, we should be clear that racism is not innate, and that it's not in the interest not only of African Americans, but of European American workers. I think we have to begin with some of that as a premise, particularly the centrality in the struggles we undertake. And then I think it's not just done as individuals. You have to try and get people together in groups or some organizational form. And I got this far when I was responding to David, I think a day or two ago. But one thing I didn't add at the time, but I want to stress now, is as you start pulling people together, and if you can unite around some of these basics, then the key task is to grow out. But I, as an organizer for many years in the labor movement, I think it's key when you start to organize and move outward, you try and go out in concentric circles. You try and develop work with those closest to you and solidify that and keep expanding and keep expanding.
I'm on the phone.
And I think Harrison, again, leaves us much to work with in terms of how we develop that work.
All right. Thank you very much for your question, Josh. Ed from Queens, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Ed. How are you doing?
All right. Yourself?
Okay. You're on the air with Jeffrey Perry.
Yeah. Just wanted to thank you and Professor Perry for this enlightening and eye-opening program about Herbert Humphrey. I had known about him years before from my cousin, actually. He enlightened me to some of his works along with Garvey. I just wanted to know, as you dedicated 39 years of your life to the study of this man, and you've uncovered a great deal of information, is there anyone, aside from the people that you've mentioned in the other questions that you answered, that took up the mantle of this intellectual giant? Is there anyone that comes to mind, or is there anyone that you can see that is even trying to follow in his footsteps?
Well, that took up the mantle of writing about Harrison?
No, his actual works, you know, his radical views on race and class and how they are similar, especially in America.
Well, he's
how to work
exactly
with them.
They're connected, but yeah, he had a group of followers. I mentioned some of these people, the people around after he dies, the people around the Hubert Harrison Memorial Church were some of the outstanding radical activists in Harlem, and was people like Hodge Kiernan and the Burroughs, husband and wife, and Richard B. Moore, people like this. They tried to build off this and develop it, but this is the most powerful country in the world, as you know and I know, and there are many obstacles and forces arrayed against challenging it in any serious way. So it's a difficult road. But directly following Harrison's lead, no, I don't know. I can't think of anybody right away, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, that I was just curious. I know that's sad, and as you stated, in America, it's a difficult road to hoe, and it oftentimes puts you in isolation. But it would be a worthy pursuit, definitely. And thank you again for the program.
Well, thank you for your comments, but that's why I'm hoping with this material being made available now, today, this is new era also, and maybe people can pick up on this. And there's so many insights throughout these two volumes. I mean, I don't even do justice when I talk on the air about Harrison. When you read in this book, chapter after chapter, you just slam your forehead and say, oh, my gosh, this is very insightful. And that's why I encourage people to read it. And it's not a quick read. You know, take time with it and with both volumes. But I think people can build off it. I think he's going to be around for a long time. As Arthur Schomburg says, he's ahead of his time. But that, he said that in 27. So here we are 80 years later, or almost 80 years later, whatever it is. And about time now. So we should pick up on it and run with it.
Definitely, definitely. I've also read the Columbia University papers by Mr. Harrison. And like you said, his concepts were ahead of his time. They're still a lot ahead of his time as far as his relationships, the relationships he draws between race and class, and how the United States uses that relationship, and how the powers that be use it to influence the lower class. And it's a hard concept to get, but it does make sense. And thank you. I'm definitely going to buy your book.
Thank you, Ed. Really appreciate it.
That's plural, Ed.
Plural, yes. Excuse me. Plural, yes. Excuse me. My apologies. Plurally, I will buy both of your books and try to disseminate them as much as I can.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Well, once more, we're at the end. I thoroughly enjoyed having you and being with you in receiving people's queries and dealing with them as expertly as you have because of the amount of research you have done, which is typical of the way you do your work. It's not a quick read. You're right about that. You have to take it a bit at a time because it's very complex. Not complicated necessarily, but complex. And it is perhaps going to be the first time you're appreciating the complexity of such an extraordinary man and the impact he has had on not movements in the United States, but outside of it, his consciousness, his vision, just extraordinary. So one more round of thanks for your patience and your cooperation and your enthusiasm. You're a real trooper, Jeffrey, and I thank you so much for being with us this week and taking on the assignment with the enthusiasm that you have had in this entire week of you're just excited about the work that you do, and it catches on. We're excited too. So thank you once again for everything that you have done.
Thank you, Utrecht. And if I just may add one last sentence for your listeners, remember this two-volume biography of Hubert Harrison is, I believe, the first full-length multi-volume biography of an Afro-Caribbean and only the fourth of an African-American after those of Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Langston Hughes. He is a giant of Black history and Afro-Caribbean history.
Thanks again. Okay. We will see each other. Today is Friday. The weekend comes up. Monday, we'll return to the madness of Washington and find out what they've decided to do. We kind of have a clue, though. I think most of us have a clue as to how this will turn out. So we'll get back on that track. And what I would like to encourage you to do is to take this information that we shared this week and mobilize on it. Tell people about it. Get the books. Start your library. Start your really serious library and begin to build on it. You may not think of it now this way, but when you have a great library, it is worth passing on, and it is a treasure for whoever you designate to receive it. So it's a great investment from all kinds of angles. Please do buy the books and put them in your library and read them. Take it a little at a time, but make sure you read them. It's the weekend. You're going to have a good time, I hope, just relaxing, taking it easy. Surround yourself with people who bring good dimension to your life. Rest a bit. And then we'll see each other on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thank you again, Eutrice. Bye.